Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
September 11th, 2001. 6 a.m., Portland, Maine. Five men, secretly armed with knives, prepare to board a plane to Los Angeles via Boston. Their flight attendant that day, Betty Ann Ong, is especially excited about the trip. After she lands in L.A., she'll be meeting with her sister to plan a Hawaiian vacation. 8:13 a.m. An air traffic controller at the FAA's Boston Center directs the flight to turn 20 degrees right. The pilot acknowledges the order. But as the controller sends more instructions, there is nothing but radio silence. 8:19 a.m. Air traffic control receives a call. It's flight attendant Betty Ann Ong. She, too, cannot contact the cockpit, and she is now hiding in the back of the plane.
Cockpit's not answering. Somebody's stabbed in business class. And I think there's mace that we can't breathe. I don't know. I think we're getting hijacked.
Which flight are you on?
Flight 12.
And what seat are you at? Ma'am, are you there?
Carrying dozens of men, women, and children, Betty's flight has been hijacked by terrorists who have diverted the plane towards New York City. Meanwhile, CIA analyst Mike Scheuer is at home, watching the tragedy unfold on television. He immediately knows who is responsible, the person he was in charge of finding not long ago, a little-known Saudi terrorist named Osama bin Laden.
When those planes hit on 9/11, we had known they were going to do that. Not that specific day or that specific target, but that medium of operation, they intended to do that since at least 1995.
And it wouldn't be until 2011 that the hunt for the world's most wanted man was finally brought to an end. This is The Killing of Osama bin Laden, Part 1. From Audioboom and World Media Rights, this is Covert, a podcast about the shadowy world of international espionage and top-secret military operations. I'm Jamie Rennell, and I'm going to take you on a deep dive into history's greatest classified missions to learn about the brave soldiers, government agents, and law enforcement personnel who risked their lives to terminate the world's most wanted, eliminate terrorist threats, and protect the lives of countless innocent people. In this first episode, we'll trace the origins of Osama bin Laden and the people who were tasked to find him. Who was this man? When did he first get the CIA's attention? And what led up to his masterminding of 9/11? We'll start with the first attack on the Twin Towers 8 years earlier. February 26th, 1993. A yellow van pulls into the subterranean parking garage beneath the Vista Hotel in Lower Manhattan. Several men jump out and unravel four 20-foot-long pieces of fuse wire. They ignite the fuses, pile into the car that was following them, and speed off. At 12:17 p.m., the truck explodes, carving a 100-foot crater through four levels of the World Trade Center tower above. Six people, including a pregnant woman, are killed, and over 1,000 injured. Though it was unsuccessful, their mission was to topple the two towers into each other, likely killing tens of thousands of people and causing massive destruction to Lower Manhattan. Investigators later uncover the plot's ringleader, Ramzi Youssef, had been staying in a guest house owned by a then little-known radical named Osama bin Laden, leader of a terrorist organization called Al-Qaeda. Evidence also revealed that bin Laden had financed the bombing and that he had actually been called by one of the co-conspirators after the attack, further solidifying his status as a person of interest. Michael Scheuer was chosen to head up a small CIA team dedicated to finding bin Laden. The team was codenamed Alex Station.
It helped to put Al-Qaeda on the map. What it helped to do most of all was to convince at least the intelligence community that a threat within the United States was not was not impossible, and it could involve more than just a shooting or a kidnapping.
What Scheuer didn't know yet was that this would begin an exhaustive 15-year manhunt to find one of the most dangerous people to have ever existed. On March 10, 1957, the billionaire Muhammad Awad's 17th child was born. The boy was to be the heir to a vast Saudi construction empire. His name was the Arabic word for lion, Osama.
Osama bin Laden was born. His father was a very wealthy businessman.
That's Kevin Shipp, a veteran CIA counterterrorism officer who spent years researching Osama bin Laden's life.
He built a lot of the Saudi palaces. He built some roads, there are airports, some maritime ports. He was worth many, many millions of dollars, and it's been estimated that Osama himself was worth about $30 million. So his father was very wealthy. He was very high up in society in Saudi Arabia, as was bin Laden himself.
More after the break. This week's show is sponsored by Hims. Look, I'm going to share some intel with you. These are the facts. 66% of men lose their hair by age 35. I know, I'm 46. You're thinking there's nothing you can do. Case closed. But you're wrong. You need to check out forhims.com. It's a one-stop shop for hair loss, skin care, sexual wellness, all for men. Maybe you've noticed your hairline slowly moving back. Things starting to feel a little thin. I mean, mine is. The fact is, the sooner you do something, the better. You can't just sit back and watch. You have to act. Hims connects you with real doctors and medical-grade solutions to treat hair loss. These aren't snake oil pills or gas station counter supplements. Come on, you know better than that. Hims offers prescription solutions backed by science. You go to forhims.com, answer a few quick questions, a real doctor reviews it. Products are shipped directly to your door. Done. Easy. No hassles. Here's the deal. Listeners to Covert get a trial month of Hims for just $5 today, right now, while supplies last. See website for full details. But this would cost hundreds if you went to a doctor or a pharmacy. That's crazy, right? Go to forhims.com/ops. That's forhims.com/ops. forhims.com/ops. The fact is, anyone can fight hair loss. I know I am, with Hims. What are you waiting for? forhims.com/ops. Throughout his childhood, Osama was educated in his father's work. He received training in how to use explosives for blasting out mountains to make way for roadways. Knowledge he would one day put to use with devastating effect. He also got something else from his father.
Osama bin Laden's father was a very, very devout Muslim. He venerated the Prophet Muhammad, and who essentially was his model of his religious faith. He also emulated the Prophet Muhammad's military side, his battles, the strict living that the Prophet Muhammad engaged in, and also the global borderless side of Islam in terms of eventually the Islamic faith being the faith of the entire world.
Bin Laden was taught a severe perspective, that the Prophet Muhammad was more than just a religious figure. He was also a great general who used warfare and violence to spread Islam. This extremist view of Islam would inform bin Laden's belief in establishing a caliphate, a world that forcibly lives under Islamic law. In 1978, at the age of 20, he enrolled at the King Abdul Aziz University in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, where he studied a range of subjects including economics, business administration, and management, as well as his father's trade, civil engineering. By this time, he had inherited a multi-million dollar fortune after his father died in a plane crash.
Bin Laden's university days came at a time when the Muslim world had been shocked, if you would, by the defeat by the Israelis in the 67 war and then in the 73 war. Bin Laden termed his generation the generation of defeat. And so it was a time of depression, but also a time of looking for answers. How do we make this work in the sense of how do we have Arabs be able to stand up for themselves or Muslims be able to stand up for themselves?
It was here that Bin Laden was exposed to the works of the radical Palestinian professor Abdullah Azzam, a chief member of the Islamic Muslim Brotherhood. It transformed the impressionable young man.
Azzam was almost fanatical in his desire to see the elimination of the State of Israel through violent jihad, and as well as a battle against the West. The West is the great imperial evil in the world. So Azzam came from fighting the Israelis in Palestine, and his theology was the destruction of Israel and eventually the destruction of the West.
To Azzam, an attack on one Muslim was an attack on all. His motto was brutally uncompromising. The rifle alone. No negotiations, no conferences, and no dialogue.
Each individual has a responsibility, whether it's to be a fighter, a contributor in terms of money or goods, prayers. And Bin Laden very much took that to heart and used it as the core of his appeal to the Muslim world.
Ruthless, violent, extreme jihad, or holy war, ultimately became the defining force in Bin Laden's version of Islam. Then, on Christmas Eve 1979, the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan. It's this event that completes the 22-year-old Osama bin Laden's metamorphosis from an idealistic student into a terrorist capable of mass murder. Martin McCauley is a renowned historian and expert on the Soviet Union.
Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979 is seminal because it's the first time that a Western power, the Soviet Union, invades a Muslim country and tries to communize it, tries to overcome Islam, overcome a Muslim tradition and Muslim way of life.
Bin Laden was galvanized by how the Afghan people fought back to preserve the country's Muslim way of life against such a superpower. He was especially impressed by the Mujahideen, the Islamic holy warriors.
Mujahideen are inspirational, because then you have a group who, in fact, represent Islam and will fight the infidel and will fight for the future of Islam, and they can develop into a greater anti-Western force. And so out of this comes the Taliban and eventually Al-Qaeda.
The words of his mentor, Abdullah Azzam, suddenly became real. And like thousands of other young Muslim men, Bin Laden traveled to Peshawar, Pakistan, just 30 miles from the Afghanistan border, in order to support these freedom fighters and their war against the communists.
This was an imperialistic power invading what was considered by many Muslims to be the true Muslim country, and that was Afghanistan. So for the Soviets to come into Afghanistan for Bin Laden and Azzam, his mentor, that was an outrageous event of an imperialistic power coming in and taking over a Muslim world. It became Bin Laden's chief goal in life to enter into Afghanistan and join up with the Mujahideen and fight.
There, he found a city teeming with Mujahideen, drawn from many different countries, the same way he had been. And while Osama had no military experience to offer, he realized there was another way that he could help.
Bin Laden started out financing the operation from afar, from a distance, again providing money and weapons and equipment to the Afghan fighters.
But Osama didn't just use his own money to fund the Afghan resistance. He also lobbied wealthy Saudis back home. And he was a brilliant fundraiser, bringing in $50 million a year for the cause. But by 1984, he realized the resistance needed more than just money. It needed organization. With thousands of Arab fighters coming in from Egypt, Syria, and Jordan, there was chaos. And so Bin Laden used his business school discipline. He tracked every recruit's movements. He monitored and assessed their progress through training camps and their successes in battle. He personally financed this operation to the tune of $300,000 a year. It was during this, the height of the Cold War, that America and the Mujahideen found themselves sharing a common enemy, the Soviet Union. And so began one of the longest and most expensive covert operations in the CIA's history, supplying billions in dollars in arms through the Pakistani Secret Services, the ISI, to the Afghan-Soviet War.
The CIA knew he was there by the middle 1980s, but he didn't want to talk to us. He hated us at that point. His position was always that when the Soviets are taken care of, we'll take care of the Americans. And frankly, we didn't pay an extraordinary amount of attention to him because he was on the side of the angels at that time. He was killing Soviets. What his role was a developing role in Afghanistan. He initially showed up as sort of the representative of his very, very wealthy family, visiting clinics, visiting wounded Mujahideen, bringing them candies or food, writing checks for their families so they could live while the gentleman or the fighter was in the hospital. He then became what in American politics you would call a bag man. He carried money for the Kuwaitis, for the Saudis, for the Emiratis, for basically every government and private sector person on the peninsula, on the Arab peninsula, that was donating to the Mujahideen to facilitate their war effort. He evolved from that point into something of a combat engineer. The Mujahideen, the one thing they lacked for a great deal of the war was air defense. And so he brought construction equipment from his family in Saudi Arabia and built bunkers, tunnels, caves, fighting positions with that equipment down in the southeast area of Afghanistan around Host. And finally in 86, 87, 88, he decided that it was important for a Muslim force to be built that would survive the end of the war.
Bin Laden's successes against the Soviets were seen as a positive development by the American government. But the CIA uncovered something alarming. Far beyond just battling the Soviets, he was gaining his own followers and encouraging them to become far more violent.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
After the withdrawal of the Soviet Union, the Mujahideen forces, composed of different tribal factions, did not unite under one banner or government. Instead, out of these splintered factions came different groups, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, among others.
When the Soviets were driven out, it was proven to him and all the other Muslims that began to idolize him that it could be done, that the Muslims could drive out a world power. He was looked at as a great idol, and that was a defining moment in his life. In their mind, of course, using the U.S.'s missiles and equipment and things, as well as bin Laden's own, in their mind, they had done it. They'd driven the imperialistic Soviet Union out of Afghanistan and then decided to take that to the rest of the world outside of Afghanistan in the form of Al-Qaeda.
From the time bin Laden organized Al-Qaeda, he viewed it as an enduring organization that would move on from after Afghanistan to help Muslims who were defending Islam in other areas of the world. He never regarded Al-Qaeda primarily as a fighting organization after the Afghan War. He saw it as the vanguard of a bigger movement,
of a bigger jihad. He was outspoken, if you will, in his saying that our job is to inspire, instigate other Muslims to join the jihad.
Declassified documents revealed that around 1985, bin Laden began to fund terror cells in Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Pakistan. Throughout the late 80s into the 90s, he continued to build and expand his growing terror network throughout the Middle East region and Africa. On December 29, 1992, there was a bombing at a hotel in Somalia. This was considered by intelligence officers to be al-Qaeda's first attack. In 1996, Cindy Storer, part of a team of CIA intelligence analysts, dubbed the Sisterhood, along with Mike Scheuer, traced Osama back to Afghanistan. There, he had paired up with an extremist regime, the Taliban, who provided a safe haven for his terrorist operations. From his refuge in Afghanistan, Osama bin Laden was able to set up what American intelligence officials were referring to as Terrorism Incorporated, a syndicate focused on turning violent jihad into a global phenomenon.
But the question was he just the financier, or was he involved operationally?
In less than a year, Scheuer and Storer's team would find out. The team had some extraordinarily good luck. An insider from a training camp in Sudan simply walked into the American embassy ready to talk. The man claimed to be one of Osama bin Laden's former bodyguards, and he proceeded to give a detailed description of al-Qaeda's advancing operations. The anonymous walk-in told them bin Laden wasn't just financing missions, he was organizing them. He was running training camps and writing handbooks for bombings and assassinations. He was working to procure and build weapons of mass destruction. He was selecting teams to plant bombs on planes, and even to crash small aircrafts into CIA headquarters. And it was bin Laden himself who came up with the name al-Qaeda, Arabic for the base.
Calling it al-Qaeda in a way, I mean, is a indicative of his sort of ambition.
Author and journalist Greg Miller has spent years writing about bin Laden for major news outlets.
He calls it, this is the base, this is an organization. This is, he wants to make this more hierarchical, and he succeeds at that. This goes from fighters arriving in Afghanistan and Pakistan and waiting for assignments and going off and doing their own thing to being something that has training camps, that has locations, that has compounds where people are based. It has a system wherein fighters can arrive in through Pakistan or through Afghanistan and find their way to the fight. There's a pipeline. And he is largely responsible for putting that sort of structure in place.
We were very sure that al-Qaeda was an organization the like of which we had never seen before in terms of manpower, focus, discipline, and geographic reach.
Then, as if to leave no doubt, in August 1996, bin Laden officially declared fatwa, or a declaration of war, on America and Israel. Here's an excerpt from a translation by the Combating Terrorism Center at West Point Military Academy. My Muslim brothers of the world, your brothers in Palestine and in the land of the two holy places are calling upon your help and asking you to take part in fighting against the enemy, your enemy and their enemy. The Americans and the Israelis. They are asking you to do whatever you can, with one's own means and ability, to expel the enemy, humiliated and defeated, out of the sanctities of Islam.
It was not rocket science to figure out that this man was deadly serious. He was telling us, we're coming after you.
We knew they were planning a big attack, but we didn't know where, what or where.
August 7th, 1998. 10:30 a.m., Nairobi, Kenya. A truck drives through the bustling city streets, weaving its way through a market in the center of town, and arrives in front of the U.S. Embassy. Due to traffic, the truck is brought to a halt near a protective fence outside the front of the building. But as the traffic clears, the truck doesn't follow the cars in front. Instead, it turns and drives into a small side road leading to the back of the embassy building. Inside the vehicle is a 2,000-pound bomb. The two men detonate it from inside. 212 are dead in the aftermath, with 4,000 wounded and trapped inside the rubble. 9 minutes later, and 400 miles away in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, a refrigerator truck slams on its brakes in front of the American embassy. The explosions are timed to maximize civilian death and injury. 11 people die. A further 85 are injured.
One of the dramatic changes in Osama bin Laden and his operational techniques and even his beliefs was when he changed and began using suicide bombers in his attacks. And then what that created for the first time in history was an army of essentially smart bombs. These were bombs with human brains that they could think, they could navigate, they could change plans, they could blend into crowds and commit acts of terror that up till that time could never be committed in such a secretive fashion or such an operational fashion.
We knew we were 10 years behind on following this issue. I mean, we could feel it, and we were playing catch up all the time, desperately trying to get ahead so that we could start predicting or forecasting what it was these guys were going to do.
After the bombings of the embassies, they became much more security conscious, not staying too long in any one place, sending out, when they left their headquarters, sending out two or three convoys going in different directions. So it became increasingly hard over the years to really pin down his location.
A few weeks after the bombings, local informants reported that bin Laden was heading toward a terrorist training camp. Mike Scheuer.
We developed intelligence from several sources that bin Laden was going to travel from Kandahar City to Host, where we spoke earlier. He had been experienced there during the war against the Soviets. And he was going to meet with Pakistanis and various other kind of Islamist fighters there.
The following day, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, George Tenet, presented to President Bill Clinton this evidence that over 200 Islamic militants and al-Qaeda leaders, including bin Laden, are about to gather at the Zawar Kili training complex. Clinton gave the go-ahead for a massive missile strike. At 7:30 p.m. local time in Sudan, two U.S. Navy warships in the Red Sea fired 14 Tomahawk missiles at a factory believed to be operated by bin Laden. The missiles obliterated the building. They had been designed to limit casualties to a minimum, killing only a security guard outside. Meanwhile, 650 miles away, four U.S. Navy ships sat off the coast of Pakistan. 66 more Tomahawk missiles were launched towards the terrorist training facility in Khast. But this time, the attack was designed to create maximum carnage. At the terrorist training facility, a large area in the middle of the camp was pulverized. But strangely, no one was killed. The trainee terrorists run into the middle of the base to celebrate their narrow escape. But the missiles hadn't missed. A second wave of Tomahawk missiles erupt several feet above them, spraying shrapnel in an 800 by 400 foot area. The desert camp became a smoldering wall of fire. But what about bin Laden?
As it turned out, the information we had was good, but bin Laden at the last moment decided to go to Kabul, and we, of course, missed him.
To Mike Scheuer and his team, missing bin Laden was a huge blow.
Between May of 98 and May of 99, we had 10 opportunities. Two opportunities to capture him and eight different opportunities to use the U.S. military, either through missiles or fixed-wing aircraft to kill him. But we had 10 opportunities.
Several months later, bin Laden was spotted again, this time by surveillance drones and voice recognition software. He was at a training camp near Kandahar, Afghanistan. The camp specialized in bomb construction and assassination techniques. There, jihadis were being prepared to serve as suicide bombers. Some were even sent around the world to enroll in commercial flight training. Something big was being planned. In an attempt to limit regional friction, President Clinton authorized Scheuer's team to use a new weapon, the remotely operated armed drone. They planned to guide a precision bomb into the heart of bin Laden's lair. But it was winter, and the weather in Afghanistan was so severe that the operation was put on hold until spring. But before then, George W. Bush was sworn in as the new president.
They always come into office with a worldview and they're going to accomplish certain things. And then you hit them with something that they had no idea about. And really nobody, not many people had an idea about it. And they've somehow got to integrate that into their presidency. That is not easy, not easy at all.
The newly elected George W. Bush was not too concerned with bin Laden's mob of desert fighters. Despite warnings from multiple security agencies, no one was able to pinpoint a specific threat. The Bush administration felt it could not justify terminating bin Laden and refused to reauthorize the CIA's proposed drone strike.
Looking at this historically, it takes at least 10 years to get people to come around to understanding that you have a new problem.
In the spring of 2001, bin Laden was in his sixth year of hiding. Every time surveillance teams picked up chatter from the terrorist training camps, the conversations were bolder and more confident. Cindy Storer.
Then we started to see something that was clearly something else. And the chatter, we were hearing things like Armageddon, and you know you're fighting against time. And you know that people are going to die.
September 11th, 2001, 5:45 a.m. Mohammed Atta and Abdul Aziz Ul Amari arrived at Portland Airport on their way to Boston. They pass easily through the airport's security screenings. They're part of a group of 19 men who are about to kill almost 3,000 innocent civilians. It will be the worst atrocity on U.S. soil in modern history since Pearl Harbor. In our next episode, we will examine the impact of the attack of 9/11 and how intelligence services spent the next 10 years tracking down the most elusive criminal on the planet. Black Ops is an Audio Boom original, hosted by me, Jamie Rennell. It is produced by Ben Hosley and Rachel Jacobs, with additional production by Pascal Hughes. We had editing help by David Markowitz and production help from Gerald Zabengwa and Damian Thorpe. Thanks to Hims for sponsoring this episode. If you haven't already, don't forget to follow us on Spotify or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorite shows. And if you've got some time, give us a review. Covert is an Audio Boom and World Media Rights co-production, hosted by me, Jamie Rennell. It is produced by Audio Boom's Ben Hosley and Rachel Jacobs, and by Pascal Hughes for World Media Rights. We had editing help by David Markowitz, with additional production from World Media Rights by Gerald Zabengwa and Damian Thorpe. David McNabb is the series' creative director, and the executive producers for Audio Boom are Brendan Regan and Stuart Last.